Hello and welcome to The Improverbial, a podcast where we unearth obscure sayings and phrases from around the world, invent absurd new proverbs, and talk about things mundane, spurious, irrelevant, and profound. I am the capitalist, Pete Kirkwood.
And I'm Lisa Favette, the tilt thinker. I've been doing and coaching improv for many years. Pete and I have been doing improv together for some of those years. This podcast is a mashup of Pete's interest in the science of well-being, my background in education and human development, our shared fascination with the world's idiomatic weirdness, and our superpowers in improv comedy. We are the Improverbializers.
Woohoo!
Yeah!
Okay, hey everybody. Oh, I've missed you so much. I'm so glad to be here doing another episode of the Improverbial.
It's always fun. It's always the highlight of my week.
Of my whole morning. All right. So today, the proverb that we are going to explore is a fly in the ointment. A fly in the ointment. And so this is this is probably pretty well known. I think most people have heard it more or less, your native English speakers. It is an idiomatic expression, which refers to a drawback, especially one that was not at first apparent. So like everything's perfect. And then this one little thing is like kind of wrecks it all.
Yeah. Like a flaw. There's a flaw there.
Yeah.
Or a fly.
Yeah. A flaw in something that would otherwise be super duper perfect.
Exactly.
Is not to be confused with flying ointment, which is a hallucinogenic ointment that is said to have been used by witches in Europe as far back as the 1500s, 1600s.
Oh, really?
Yeah, sorry to distract you right away.
Those witches knew their hallucinogenics.
Flying ointment. This is fly in the ointment. All right. Likely source of this is the King James Bible, Ecclesiastes. Dead flies cause the ointment of the apothecary to send forth a stinking savor. So doth a little folly in him that is in reputation for wisdom and honor. All right. So yeah,
King James. Yeah.
Oh yeah. King James. Good old King James. But yeah, flying the ointment. Back then we think of ointment as like it's something you put on like a bruise or a wound or something. It's like a healing thing. But back in the day, in the biblical times, an ointment was like what you used to anoint someone. It was like a lovely smelling oil or whatever. And so you can imagine.
Yeah. It was more ceremonial or cosmetic versus something that was healing.
Exactly. Although I'm sure there's probably a lot of gray there because, you know, in religious circles, those kind of rituals probably did have healing expectations about them. And then, but you know, you can see why, like if someone's anointing you with an ointment, you don't really want flies in there.
No, I wouldn't want any flies on there. No,
I wouldn't. Yeah. The first time this occurred as a fly in the ointment, the way we use it today, was in 1707 from the English sort of moralist John Norris in his practical treatise concerning humility. And he said, "'Tis that dead fly in the ointment of the apothecary." So
yeah. Why are all these flies in all of our creams? Have you ever opened up your medicine cabinet and like wanted to put on that like Noxzema cream, Pete, and there was a fly in there?
Well, I mean, there's flies elsewhere in my sometimes.
Okay, but not that specific.
No, I used to keep the lid on the old Noxzema.
Noxzema. So see, that helped keep flies out of your ointments.
Right. Why didn't they just have a lid on their damn ointment?
I know. Just cover it up.
It's not that hard.
No, it's not.
Yeah. Flies can't get through the lid. So I'm going to tell you a little fly in the ointment story.
All right. I'm ready.
When my wife and I bought our house in Pennsylvania years ago, there's a wine cellar down there. And I sort of didn't really explore it that much before we bought the house, but we went down there. I was like, it's like classic, look, in the basement, super dusty, all these like wooden racks, and it's like a stone basement and it's dark and musty. And I'm like, ooh, what could be in here? So we like look around and I'm like, oh my God, there's a bottle of wine down here, like way back tucked in the dark corner of the wine store. And I pulled it out. I was like, oh my God. It was like 1962 on the label. And I looked in it but it was a Beaujolais Nouveau.
Okay.
Nouveau. Which is like, there are very few wines that are like, you do not age them.
And this was
and
one of them.
This was one of them. That was the fly in my ointment in my wine cellar.
Oh, everything was perfect. And the flaw was it's not the right kind.
Yeah. Gosh, consume. What if it was like Chateau Lafite? I don't know. I could have bought the house with that. I don't know. How much is wine worth? What the hell do I know? I probably just drunk it. I just did a Michigan past participle.
Tell me about Michigan past participles.
Jeez, I screwed up. I should have just drunk it. is, I believe, proper English. But in Michigan, they say, I should have drank it.
Drank it.
Ah, it drives me nuts. And I just
Because we love those wide, bright vowels. Yeah, we do. We like to talk that way.
I'm from Traverse. I'm from Traverse City.
Traverse City. Because it used to be Traverse City. Because of from the drunk to the drank to the truv to the tra... No.
Oh,
okay.
Gosh, wow.
Sorry. No, yeah. This is the...
What have you got about flies in the ointment?
This is the factual part of our show.
Yeah, no making things up.
Well, you know, I think it's interesting. You know, flies get a really bad rap. Mm-hmm. You know, and the worst thing that could happen to your anointing ointment is to have a fly in it.
Anointment.
I tend to be one where it's like, come on, is it really that bad? Like, oh, a fly landed on my food. Oh no, I can't eat it. And I'm like, come on, get over yourself. So I wanted to look it up. And I really, really wanted to find information to show like, hey, it's actually not that bad. But the facts are, it's pretty gross if a fly is on your food. Did you find something similar?
No, but do you have more on that? That's fascinating.
You know, I thought, oh, I'm hoping
to. I kind of tend to be like that too. I'm like, oh, it's okay. It's just, I just dropped my ice cream cone in a turd. It's just a turd.
It's just fine. Just wipe it off. Just lick it off.
Tell me about flies.
Well, I always heard, oh, as soon as a fly lands on your food, it vomits. And I thought, oh, this is an old wives' tale. I'm going to just debunk that on this episode. I'm going to be a hero to millions. But it is true that flies, they can't eat anything solid. They have to slurp up liquids. No. So in order to make your delicious hamburger liquidy, they regurgitate some of their saliva, and then that mixes with, say, your hamburger meat, and then now they can slurp up your hamburger meat.
Was their saliva like some kind of dissolving magical acid?
You know, I didn't read that, but it does have, you know, it's liquid, so then it kind of, it's getting the hamburger juices mixed in with it.
It really is kind of super gross.
But let me just say this too, you know, not fly saliva isn't necessarily, you know, an awful thing. It's gross to think there's saliva, anybody's saliva, but
especially a fly's.
But it isn't necessarily, oh, fly saliva is, you know, is going to cause you terrible
instantaneous death.
Exactly.
Fly saliva would you have to drink, I wonder, to cause instantaneous death?
I did not look that up, but I would like to find out, like a water bottle full of fly saliva, would that be a really bad thing?
Where were you going? Keep going.
But I was just going to say, so I don't know about fly saliva, but we do know that flies do carry lots of diseases.
Yeah. They walk on everything.
They walk. That's how they taste. Their feet.
Get
that's
out of
their
here.
Taste. So when you see the fly standing there and lifting up all its feet,
really?
That's how it tastes. And it determines is this something worth eating or not. Wow. And then, oh, it is. So I'm going to vomit right now is what the,
that's what I do when I find that something is tasty to eat. I usually vomit all over it first.
I've been out to dinner with you before and that's
so
true,
much
folks.
More delectable. No, we keep on lying true. In the first part. We're not supposed to lie yet.
I know we can't help but lie, Pete.
We suck at not lying.
We suck at it. So I've got a bunch of fly facts, but before I go into that, kind of things did you look up?
Well, I kind of went a little bit with the fly thing too. And like, maybe it's not so bad. So I was like, is there any time when flies will be good in the ointment? You know, what's good about that? So there was an article by Yakovlev, Kruglikova, and Chernish in the Entomological Review called Caliphoridae Flies in Medical Biotechnology. Blowflies and their medical applications have attracted the attention of biologists and doctors for more than a century, they say. The best known uses of surgical maggots for the treatment of infected wounds and ulcers. This is something that's fairly well known, although it's also super duper gross, is like putting maggots on an infected wound and they eat all the gross rotten stuff. And then what's left is like more or less a clean wound. But what they found is that there's another promising direction. And they say it's the use of flies as producers of pharmacologically active substances. They have found compounds with antiviral and anti-tumor activity in blowfly maggots, and it might be useful even for the treatment of viral infections. And these enzymes and these antimicrobial peptides are a group of drug candidates that actually are receiving attention. Like, it's maybe more than just eating the rotten flesh. So we may actually be able to derive other, like, health medicinal benefits from freaking maggots.
It's so nasty. But it's so cool. I love it whenever we can find like things that already exist out in nature that are able to solve these big problems that we're having.
Yeah, and
I think there's a lot
better.
More. Yeah, the grosser the better. I was also reading about that. This maggots are there to treat gangrenous wounds.
Yeah.
And it used to be, and you need to have a maggot nurse that actually exists. During American Civil War time, there were maggot nurses. They were there to monitor because, of course, you only want the maggots to eat away the dead skin, not any of the healthy skin. So then they would
not just skin, like flesh. And
the flesh, the insides and everything.
Nastiness.
And actually, you know, I said I didn't have anything on saliva, but so the saliva, I guess, of the maggots has an antibacterial property.
That's what we're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah. So that is helpful for these wounds. It's disgusting and actually so delightful at
disgusting
the same
and
time.
Wonderful. I love it.
I was also looking up, like, what are some great things about flies? And I don't know if these are necessarily great as far as the human perspective, but it's kind of fascinating.
Frogs think they're delicious.
Frogs love them. They're a very important part of the food chain. That's true. Flies are super, super cool. We know they're really hard to catch, right? And so why is that? And of course, it's their big opticals on their huge orbital eyes.
I actually think they can see the future. Like, they know where your hand is going to be before it gets there.
Before you even know that your hand's
really
going to be there.
I really think
they can. Well, one thing is their visual processing. So humans can process 60 images per second.
Yes.
And flies can process 250 images per second. So, Pete, that's not doubling. That's not tripling. That's quadrupling how they are able to tell where things are. And that's how they can see the future.
Practically seeing the future, practically.
I know. Just think, if we could somehow duplicate that processing, we would be able to see the future.
It'd be like seeing everything in slow motion, almost. Like I'm sort of only semi-joking. I actually think that because they see things at such a high frame rate that it's almost like if we were seeing something in slow motion. That's my theory. I have never really seen inside the brain of a fly.
From a fly's perspective, the fly all of a sudden has the ability to see like we do, and then they'd perceive it as slow motion.
Or I guess you could say it that way, yeah. They see your hand coming.
You could say it that way, you know? Lisa. Lisa, you could say it that way.
So nobody else
would. Go ahead.
I'm going to go a little bit to like a big thought.
Yeah.
Big thought. And the question is about like flies in the ointment is an imperfection in an otherwise awesome thing. So the question is, do we let little disappointments and imperfections spoil otherwise great things? You know, you've got a great day planned and I don't know, you got a parking ticket when you stopped at the coffee shop to get your coffee on the way out. Are you going to let that ruin your day? You know what I mean? Like, it's like a mindset sort of thing. Maybe that bottle of Beaujolais that I found in my basement, maybe I should have opened it up and drank it. No, maybe I should have used it as vinegar. Maybe it would have been the most transportively delicious vinegar. You know, what, can we just scoop that fly out?
Yeah.
Can we maybe make some antimicrobial peptides? Is there a way?
Yeah, it's a perspective. Absolutely. Right. It's a perspective and something. Flies are the worst thing you could have in your kitchen and they are very annoying, but is it really going to ruin a meal if there's flies that landed on that perfect pot roast?
Yeah. But I'm more like figurative flies. I'm talking about like real flies. Yeah. They will like totally gross you out.
I know, but your pot roast is still fine.
When I'm going, you know, I'm on our day and then we're going to go out go to the beach or have a hike or whatever, that little parking ticket at the beginning, it's like it's like a practice you can do is like cultivate this forgetting, you know, cultivate this, scooping the fly out of the ointment and then just like use the rest of the ointment and have a wonderful day at the beach.
Yeah.
I'm mixing metaphors, of course.
Well, I can hear you on that. You know, you and I have both been like leaders in our positions, you know, and working with people and helping them in their development. And that's where a lot of my background is in human development. And, you know, there's this, you know, in giving people feedback, there's this whole like this sandwich thing, like a pro, a con, and a pro. And it's a little bit cliche, but I have to say, not only is that more useful for the person to be able to hear constructive criticism, so I do think there's some value with it. I also think as a leader needs to give that, forcing yourself to see the positive in that person is also a very good exercise as well. Mm-hmm. And it's not just lip service to it. Like as a leader, I really feel you should really, like if you can't find a positive in a person, they probably shouldn't continue with the organization. Like I've got this person here for a reason and I am going to let them know the thing I see most that shines through are these things that are just such great skills about you and ways you work and who you are. And here is something that let's look at together and that just to continue to build on your greatness and saying those in really authentically, right?
Yeah.
That, that little fly, we all got flies every once in a while.
Yeah, I think we should get rid of the criticism sandwich thing, which I don't know if everyone knows about that, but it's like this idea that you start lead with, you say a nice thing, you say the criticism, then you say a nice thing, just to be perfectly explicit about that. But yeah. Maybe we should call it like criticism ointment.
A criticism ointment. And there's a fly there, but we're going to just swat it away. You
gotta teach people how to get that fly out and then enjoy the rest of their ointment.
Pete, I'm kind of bummed.
Oh.
I came in this morning and there on the Pervert Baton was a fly. And I just don't know if I can do the episode.
I know. It walks all over and tastes it and then barfs.
I know. And disgusting. So, wait a minute.
Wait, you're wait making mi- that wait. Up.
No, it's true. But I was just thinking, Pete, you were just telling me how I shouldn't let something like that ruin my whole day. I'm going to go on, Pete.
Let's move forward.
Let's move forward. Even though there was a fly that's barfed on this Proverbatron, gosh darn it. I'm going to show that fly.
It's a great idea.
You know, Pete, first of all, to say, I want to thank the Boardman Review for giving this gorgeous Proverbatron machine and always sponsoring us and supporting us. Mm-hmm. And I think also folks should know this part of our podcast is completely made up, including that there is even a machine? Wait, no. That part is real.
This is a whole bunch of hogwash.
This is the hogwash coming up, part.
A big serving of fly infested hogwash.
With a fly in it. So I think let's get started. I'm going to just wipe off this part right here. This is where the fly was walking. Mm-hmm. Okay. The button is free and clear. I'm going to push the first.
Protractor.
The first word is protractor. Protractor.
Cool. Protractor. Okay. Here comes some, I'm going to reach around here. I'm going to reach this button here. You cleaned it, right?
Oh yeah. Yeah. It's fly. Okay. It's fly free. Okay.
Here we go. I'm gonna hit that second button. Ready?
Baby in a pram.
Oh, wow. This is interesting. It's not just a word. It's a little phrase.
Oh,
this one today is baby in a pram.
Baby in a pram.
Baby in a pram. Okay, then.
Oh, Pete. Oh gosh, the baby in the pram. Wow. So, yeah, this one isn't as known, but it's...
I didn't know about it before this, this episode.
Yeah, yeah. So the proverb is, ye old protractor hath awoken the wrath of the baby in a pram.
Yeah. Such an obscure one.
Ye old protractor hath awoken the wrath of the baby in a pram.
Yep.
Yeah. It is obscure, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, we're all familiar with the wrath of a baby in a pram.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And pram.
Especially one that just got woken up.
Right. And the pram, of course, is a stroller or a.
That's what they call them in England.
Yeah.
Did you know what that's short for?
Pram? Yeah, yes, of course I know what it's short for.
But for real, perambulator.
Perambulator, that's what I was going to say. And that means you can perambulate babies around.
You can walk all over the place.
That's right. You can walk all over, not all over the baby, but walk all over.
No, with the baby.
With the baby, yes. Yeah.
The old protractor hath awoken the wrath of a baby in a perambulator.
Yeah.
In the pram.
Short. Yeah. Yeah. And it's usually where the baby can lay down. They're not sitting up. It's usually, it's like
a bed.
That's
why they sleep in there.
It's a sleeping place. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's like a little cocoon for those babies, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, when my babies would wake up, they were wrathful.
Oh, man. The wrath of a baby.
Throwing things.
Yeah. Well, your babies are quite particular in that. I mean, they have a good arm.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Like you're.
My kid used to be, he used to hit me from across the kitchen. Yeah. With a piece of broccoli.
Right. Like some parents are working on like that grip. They're just like, oh, look at, they grip my finger. And your kid was got.
Yeah. He had a curve ball by the time he was like two.
Two. Yeah.
And that broccoli would curve down the fridge.
Now this isn't about your particular.
No, it's not.
But there are
nostalgia.
Babies out there. And that's part of, this, it was a really special baby that this came from.
Well, yeah. And it was when like, I think, you know, it's pretty obscure, but it seems to have been like when prams were like a new thing.
Yeah, and this was a new technology.
Like usually the nannies, kind of Victorian times, like the nannies were the ones pushing these perambulators, right? Yeah. Is that what you got?
That's what I had found. And there was a nanny, her name was Victoria, Victoria Principalis. And Victoria Principalis, she was known throughout the village for her nannying magic. Like she, as you could think Mary Poppins, but this is like the original, right?
Yeah, yeah. I think the story was based on Victoria Principalis.
Absolutely. Yeah. So she had a young charge, you know, there wasn't any child that she could not lull to sleep. But she had some challenge with this baby. That's for sure.
Yeah, it's legendary. This baby could scream. You could hear it in the next village.
The decibels, they couldn't measure decimals back then, but they would measure them using protractors.
Yeah, that's a little known thing, because what they would do is, like, if you chart the protractor, if you chart the kind of, you graph out the volume of a scream.
Right.
And the
angle of which the scream was coming from one village to the other village. So if you were, say, a neighboring village, that was one certain angle. But in order to hear it, it was three villages away. They could hear this baby scream. That was when they discovered the angle, the protractor measurement of these screams were uncharted before. Yeah.
And so the particular baby at issue here was Alistair McDuffie.
Yeah, Alistair.
Alistair was the young son of the Duke and Duchess McDuffie. I forget which county it was, but in Northern England.
It was in Berwickshire.
Yeah,
Berwickshire. Okay, yeah, now, of course, this is aristocracy where you're kind of born into this, but the McDuffies were actually very innovative. Like, they not only had money from inheritance, but they had money from their resourcefulness.
Yeah. Yeah. The Duke McDuffie, Alistair was actually a junior. So it's senior Alistair McDuffie senior. He was quite an inventor. He was well known. I mean, he did have that landed aristocracy thing going on.
Yeah.
But Alistair was Alistair Jr. was just the first of seven children.
Seven Alistairs?
No.
I hadn't read that.
Yeah. You know, he was very creative when it came to his inventions, but not his naming children. Yeah.
No.
So Duke McDuffie was the first, but Alistair, his junior, was the second. And then there were six more. Six children. Yeah, everyone was Alistair.
The girls were Allie. They'd call it Allie.
Yeah, Alice Dare McDuffie, the middle name. They would give the girls the middle name of Dare.
Dare.
Yeah.
Alistair McDuffie. And they were all very risky out there, weren't they?
But only Junior
had that scream.
Yeah,
had that scream. Yeah. So we've got Victoria Principalis thinking she can handle anything. Baby. And here she has this screamer. Miles and miles away, people knew when Alistair Jr. was awake.
Absolutely.
And so she did everything in her power to make sure Alistair Jr. didn't wake up.
No, she tried. They tried holding him underwater for a while.
And
not too long.
Yeah, just enough.
Yeah,
just
because
enough.
The theory being he would hate that so much that when he woke up, he'd be so glad it was over. With the fly being out of the ointment. Yeah,
this was not the heyday of great child development type of practices.
There was things where they would swing him from a string around and around.
Yep.
To just maybe disorient him. But he would just
wailing. Yeah. For some reason, he didn't like that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so instead of trying to kind of fight it, they decided, you know what? And because his dad was such a genius and innovator, he's like, I'm going to use this. I'm going to use this for the benefit. I'm not going to let this fly in the ointment. You know, it's a perfectly good child, except for that wailing. Exactly.
Yeah. He was well known. It's a very attractive young child.
Yeah.
So that was where his invention of his new recording device came into play, right? Yep. Then the theory was, and it turned out to be kind of a smart theory, was like they would just record the wailing and they would all practice. And as a family, they would just, they would play the recordings and they would all wail at the top of their lungs.
Oh, yeah.
Whenever young Alistair would start to lose his freaking little mind.
Yep, in that pram, absolutely. Yep.
And Victoria turns out that she was quite a strong singer, quite a strong yeller.
Yes, she was. So, yes, she had some pipes on her. Yes.
Yeah, and it worked.
It worked. So he woke up, started to scream. What happens? The whole family gathers around, starts to scream. Alistair Jr. is like, what? It would shock him.
Yeah.
It would shock him to the point where he'd stop screaming and take a listen.
Yep. And in some ways, actually, it was a precursor to those dog collars you can get now where like, you know, your dog starts to bark and there's like a little bark that comes out of the and distracts the dog. And
Yep. Well, it's a precursor because that is several inventions came from that. Exactly. This kind of the distracted sound. So any distracted sound that's out there, it's Alistair.
They call it a McDuffie.
Yeah, they call it a McDuffie.
You've heard that, right? The McDuffie technique on when it comes to this dog collars and stuff.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
So what happened was it worked, and then Alistair stopped all of his screaming. Mm-hmm. And the Duke McDuffie. Yeah. You know, he had this this protractor device that he was using to monitor and to track the decibels of the screams.
Yeah.
And now Alistair wouldn't scream.
And so it's really this ye old protractor hath awoken the wrath of the baby in a pram. The protractor didn't awaken, but it's kind of like the village and everybody surrounding, they were awoken by this new device of way of measuring and a way of distracting from something that's an annoyance.
Yeah. You know, and then the Bishop of Canterbury heard about this thing and came, and you know, the famous, the choir and the chancel choir of Canterbury Cathedral.
Absolutely.
They were so intrigued by the volume that this family was able to achieve and by this recording device that they were able to use.
And they became the McDuffie family singers.
Yeah. And it was a whole new kind of singing.
A whole new kind. Really
more like screaming.
It was a screaming and screeching. And if people can look this one up.
Yeah,
they look where punk rock started, it's a little tiny little church Canterbury County by the McDuffie. Yep. They were the first screamers. Those early punk legends such as...
what were they called? The Canterbury Crotch Pistols?
Yep. The Canterbury Crotch Pistols started there. And 100 years later, you think, punk, they're so innovative. No.
Yeah. I mean, exactly. You get like the Sex Pistols. Oh, nice job, guys.
You change it a little bit. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Anyway, yeah. I think we've kind of unraveled this mystery.
So the protractor, you know, that the McDuffie protractor. Is a root of all this and these amazing audio, the tradition that came out of that, everything from the dog collars to this new tradition of punk rock to these recording devices that the Church of England would use to like just screech the heck out of people so that they, when they finally stopped, people found themselves reaching this moment of like, Zen, like calm and peace inside the church. It's really part of why the Church of England became so strong. And so, it's just a wonderful thing, ye old protractor.
And we say it's an obscure proverb, but there's so many things in our daily lives that have come from it.
Yeah, I think people are really going to find themselves intrigued by this, and they're going to want to look up the McDuffie family, Alistair McDuffie, Victoria Prince Palace, Canterbury Cathedral.
Such all these characters.
Man, the ye old protractor hath awoken the wrath of a baby in a
pram.
Yeah.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of The Improverbial. Do you want to improvise with us? You can yes and the Improverbial podcast and be a sponsor. Please reach out to theimproverbial@gmail.com.
Yeah.